from KQED.
From KQED Radio in San Francisco, this is a special half-hour edition of the California Report. I'm Lily Jamali. PG&E has officially filed for bankruptcy protection. This as it faces tens of billions of dollars in potential liabilities from our state's recent wildfires. For the next 30 minutes, we're going to look at what this means for consumers, all of the ratepayers listening, plus fire victims filing suit against the utility. And that's where we're going to start. Our colleagues at KRCB in Santa Rosa spent today speaking with members of the community there, one of the hardest hit in 2017, to find out what they think of today's news. Let's take a listen.
PG&E will do the best they can with their lawyers to make sure that they get compensated or will not have to pay out.
So I think there's been some unfair maligning of PG&E. I don't think any entity, Con Edison, anybody, could deliver power to where it's got to go for the price that people are willing to pay in a manner that's free from the possibility of these calamities.
Me and a lot of the people around in this community are just horrified that PG&E is even being allowed to keep going.
I mean, people were affected. A lot of people right near here, their houses burned down. It seems a little odd to pay big investors back when people were affected.
I sympathize with PG&E because that's an almost impossible task we're asking them to do, you know. We live in a heavily forested area. The second you start cutting down trees, people will complain.
That was Nate St. Amand, and before him, Chuck Modern, Nicole Marie Ways, Ken Cozine, and Tim Rothschild. We should mention that we invited PG&E to join us for this conversation. The company declined but did issue a statement this morning, essentially saying that the lights will stay on, the gas will keep flowing. Joining me now here in the studio are KQED data journalist Lisa Pickoff-White, reporter Marisa Lagos, who's just back from the first bankruptcy hearing in this case, as is Amanda Riddle, one of the lead lawyers in the wildfire cases. Welcome to all of you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Hi.
Marisa, let's start with you. This was a packed hearing this afternoon. What was the mood like in the courtroom?
I mean, it was pretty professional. I didn't see a ton of actual victims or folks. It was mostly their lawyers who were, you know, representing them, wildfire victims, creditors. PG&E had maybe two dozen lawyers in there. And, you know, it was kind of business as usual. The judge, Dennis Montali, definitely has a sense of humor and was very sort of casual in his approach. And I would say that, you know, he essentially pushed most big things off until Thursday. One thing I will note, interestingly, I didn't expect this. He did say that he is going to give the public a chance to be heard, and he doesn't know if he can fix their problems. But I think that that signals at least his openness to not approaching this just like any old bankruptcy case. And it's important to note that he did oversee their first bankruptcy 18 years ago.
So Lisa Pickoff-White, we now have this bankruptcy judge, as Marisa just outlined, who is the steward of this process going forward, but he cannot determine alone who is going to pay off all of these debts. So who exactly does he have to negotiate with?
Yeah, he has to negotiate with a lot of people, along with attorneys, like my Amanda Riddle here, who are going to be arguing on behalf of fire victims. He also is going to have to deal with the California Public Utilities Commission, which might be one of the most important regulatory agencies you haven't heard of. They're going to be in the news a lot right now because the CPUC is the person who can actually set rates. And so PG&E can ask the bankruptcy judge for how much that they think they need to charge ratepayers, for instance, to pay off some of these debts. And I should note that PG&E ratepayers like myself are still paying off for some of the 2001 bankruptcy. It's still on your bill. Mm-hmm. Except the PUC actually has to approve all of that. And that's one reason that there was an emergency PUC hearing on Monday, for instance, where the PUC pre-approved actually this kind of financing to allow PG&E to continue operations, to have credit as they go forward into the bankruptcy.
And they took a lot of flack for that.
They did. There were a lot of critics, both legislators and consumer watchdog groups. In fact, one watchdog group today said that he thinks that Newsom should fire every single one of the commissioners and President Picker who voted for that.
Mm-hmm. Amanda Riddle, as a lawyer representing fire survivors, your lawsuits effectively get halted for now, if I'm understanding this correctly. Is it conceivable that victims get nothing in the end?
it's conceivable, but it's very unlikely when we're talking about a defendant, as PG&E is in our case, that has the level of financial ability to pay. PG&E just last week told investors that it had a book value of about $62 billion with an enterprise value of over that. So the chances of the victims getting nothing is very unlikely, especially when we've got the CPUC, the governor, the legislature, all stating that wildfire victims do need to be compensated. And as Marisa said, the empathy and the understanding that we saw from the bankruptcy judge today indicates that he understands that's an important component of all of this.
So you knew this was coming. Does this change your approach at all?
Well, as you said, our cases are stayed, which means they're halted in the state court. So all of the wildfire cases from 2015, 2017, and 2018 are now going to come under the bankruptcy umbrella. And so we're waiting to see what kind of process Judge Montali puts in place.
I just wanted to note, I mean, Judge Montali, in fact, joked at one point, we want the federal courts lights to stay on. You know, he lives in San Francisco. He's or in the Bay Area, at least. He's probably a PG&E ratepayer. And I think that this is such a different case than maybe some others because there is so many public safety aspects and there's so much sort of public buy-in to this utility. We all pay our bills, or most of us in Northern California, through them. And so I think that's going to be kind of fascinating to watch.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point that you make. We've been thinking about, you know, how much does it matter which judge gets appointed to this case. And at the end of the day, the people that I've been talking to say this is happening in such a public forum that there's really not that much personality you can show that's going to make an actionable difference. Do you agree with that, Amanda Riddle?
I do agree with that, though I do agree that it's important that Judge Montali is the person who presided over the prior bankruptcy of PG&E. It shows that he knows the company, he knows its operations, he knows its culture and the way it'll proceed through this bankruptcy. So I think that'll be incredibly helpful. And I think, as you know, talking about keeping the lights on, the attorneys for the wildfire victims, we've never wanted to bankrupt this company. We just really want them to change their priorities so that these disasters stop happening.
And you were also involved, it's worth noting here, in lawsuits stemming from the 2010 San Bruno pipeline explosion where 8 people died. PG&E was found at fault. What lessons does that hold for how this all may play out?
Well, we didn't have to face bankruptcy there. Frankly, the attorneys who represented PG&E in those cases were not the same attorneys that we have here. And I commend them for the way and the swiftness in which they handled those cases and resolved them. We're facing a different forum here with different counsel on the other side. So we will have to see if they have the same drive to get these things wrapped up as soon as possible for these victims.
This is Lisa. I think it's also important to note that these bankruptcy hearings are not the only ones going on right now. Because of the deadly San Bruno explosion that killed 8 people, PG&E is a convicted felon, and they are currently in probation hearings. And we're going to learn more about what goes on in that tomorrow.
All right. Well, all of you are sticking with me here, but we're going to go to New York now, where there are a lot of people on Wall Street watching all of this unfold. Allison McNeely, who covers bankruptcy for Bloomberg News in New York, is joining us. Allison, welcome to you.
Thank you.
You know, I was stunned to see PG&E shares rise more than 15% on a day that it is filing for Chapter 11. It's conceivable that those shares could end up being worthless. Can you explain why we saw this kind of rally?
Yes, it's certainly unusual because a company's shares will typically fall when it's going to file for bankruptcy. However, they rose today on the expectation from investors that there might actually be enough money after the company pays its wildfire claims and its debt in bankruptcy to leave something for the shareholders. That's not typical, but PG&E said in its bankruptcy filing that it has about $20 billion more in assets than debts, which is maybe driving some of this thought on the part of shareholders that there could be something left for them and that their shares are not, in fact, worthless.
So from the investor perspective, there is still value left in this company. We've talked about a little bit already what happened in 2001, the first time that PG&E went through this. Remind us, Allison, what happened to shareholders, bondholders? How did those groups fare?
Mm-hmm. So in 2001, that bankruptcy took about 3 years to resolve. And interestingly, the company's shares never fell below the $11 range. For comparison, they're trading around $14 right now after that rally today. Again, that's unusual. Also in 2001, we saw PG&E bondholders paid back in full. However, about $8 billion of costs were passed on to California ratepayers as a result of the previous restructuring, as has already been touched on.
Yeah, so those investors did a lot better by and large in that bankruptcy than your average bankruptcy investor would. What about ratepayers, Allison?
So ratepayers saw about $8 billion in costs passed on to them. The company did a few different things to do that. One of the things that we saw the company do after its 2001 bankruptcy was issue new bonds or new debt that was paid out interest from the electricity payments by Californians. So essentially, their electricity bills paid the interest on the bonds. And that is something that some people on Wall Street are speculating could happen again.
Allison, this is Marisa Lagos. You know, I've been covering this as a politics reporter. I'm just curious for your thoughts. I was looking back, you know, in before the 2017 fires, PG&E was trading at like $68 a share, so a far cry from, you know, the $12, $14 mark we're at now. But a lot of their assets, it seems, are things that maybe they can't sell, right? Like the infrastructure still has to exist in order for all of us to get our power. Do you think that there's any, I don't know if confusion is the right word, but sort of maybe the over-optimism by investors here?
Mm-hmm. So there's sort of two aspects to that. One, there is some speculation that the company could be looking to sell its natural gas assets, and there could be some buyers for that. The other speculation that I'm hearing in the market right now is that perhaps a buyer could come in and buy a piece of the company or buy the whole company. There are other investors, other companies out there that are in the electricity space that, you know, PG&E would be a very attractive asset for them. If they can solve the wildfire claims issue, which is a big if, of course.
Yeah, and the potential sale of those natural gas assets was a story broken by NPR's Eric Westervelt. And I know from my conversations with legislators that that actually, I think, really hurt sentiment, hurt this drive among politicians in Sacramento to help this company. That's what they say, sort of behind closed doors anyway. Allison McNeely of Bloomberg News covers bankruptcy in New York. We really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to go now to Chicago, where University of Chicago law professor Douglas Baird joins us by phone. Welcome to you, Professor.
Good to talk to you.
Good to have you. Thinking back again to 2001, the last time PG&E ended up in bankruptcy, there were lawyers, there were accountants, the so-called turnaround experts, and none of these personnel are cheap. They weren't then, and they are even more expensive now. How much will PG&E have to pay for their services?
Typically, in a large bankruptcy like this, 2-3% of asset value, and you can look at that two ways. On the one hand, you can say that's less than you pay a realtor to sell your house, and a bankruptcy is the equivalent of a merger and acquisition or another large transaction. It's the equivalent to a sale, and so that looks like it's not very much. But on the other hand, 2-3% of $50 billion is real money.
Yeah, and so is it viewed as worth it, this investment in going through this process instead of trying to do it without going through Chapter 11?
Well, you don't want to have to go through Chapter 11 unless you have to, but PG&E has large liabilities, large tort liabilities, and these potentially are large enough to interfere with its ability to get its act together and get its operational act together and sort out all the other problems it has on the ground. So, again, it's a bad option, but that doesn't mean it's not the best option available.
And what do you make of this claim? And Amanda Riddle, I'd love it if you could weigh in on this also. One of the things we've been talking a lot about today is this is a solvent company. They have more assets than they have liabilities on their balance sheet. And so I wonder, you know, that's one of the key arguments that a lot of stakeholders who have said, do not do this, do not go through bankruptcy, that they have raised time and again. And I just wonder if you had any takeaways on that front, you know, having read through some of the material that we saw today.
Well, again, I think you need to understand that a fundamental principle of bankruptcy is all non-bankruptcy substantive rights are supposed to be respected. So in theory, all the tort victims have to be paid in full, 100 cents in the dollar, before the shareholders receive anything. That's sort of a fundamental bankruptcy principle. Now, what's happened, of course, is to say you've got a substantive right is not to say you vindicate it in the same way. And the bankruptcy forum is a different forum. And, of course, there's a fear that in bankruptcy, some people who really have non-bankruptcy rights are going to be lowballed. And that's a fear you'd have to worry about.
Amanda Riddle, how has that argument, this notion that this is a solvent company, which they are clearly based on the paperwork that we saw today, how does that figure into your argument as a lawyer representing these wildfire victims?
Well, that's exactly right. All of these wildfire victims should be paid 100 cents on the dollar because PG&E has sufficient assets, they say so themselves, to cover all of these liabilities. And, you know, the idea that this was the best option for the wildfire victims, I think is untrue, and that's not what was said specifically, but that's what PG&E is saying. They could have, if they wanted to consolidate all of these wildfire cases together, they could have petitioned the Judicial Council to bring them all together and address them all simultaneously. They didn't need to file bankruptcy and put these wildfire victims at risk of not getting paid the compensation to which they're entitled.
Professor Baird, what has been your read on the role that regulators have played here? The CPUC, which regulates them from the state side, has come under quite a bit of fire for not doing their jobs. What's your take there in terms of safety, first and foremost?
Well, you know, again, as a bankruptcy person, the most fundamental thing to emphasize is bankruptcy doesn't change the power of the regulators or the competency of the regulators. And that just continues for better or for worse. Bankruptcy is not involved with telling people how to conduct their affairs. The basic rule is if you're in bankruptcy, you have to play by the same rules as everyone else. And if you're a utility subject to utility regulation, that continues, and bankruptcy doesn't change that. What bankruptcy does is it tries to figure out who has claims against the assets and how you sort those things out and how you do it in a way that really respects non-bankruptcy rights. That includes the rights of the bondholders, but includes the rights of the tort victims. And again, just to comment on whether you could have a consolidated proceeding that sorts out the rights of the tort victims under state law, the answer to that is absolutely yes. The worry you have is that if you're sorting out those rights and you have fundamental changes you need to make in your operations, you may not have access to the capital markets that are going to be needed to make those changes. You may not be able to borrow additional money if you're not in bankruptcy, if you have all these liabilities hanging over you. That's a big operational fear. No, again, I can't speak to the specifics of PG&E, but the basic question you have to ask is not can you handle these tort claims outside of bankruptcy, but can you do it in a way that also allows the firm to continue to make the changes it needs to make in order to confront the climate change and other things that it needs to figure out.
All right. Well, University of Chicago Law Professor Douglas Baird, we appreciate your time. Thank you. And Lisa Pickoff-White, you know, I want to talk to you based on that last point that he made. The omniscient regulator turns out to be not so omniscient after all. What have we learned about, you know, the CPUC and the oversight that they have done? Is the public being too hard on them?
Well, I think that really depends on who you talk to. We've heard state legislators who say they are carefully looking at the CPUC. I think a lot of people who I've spoken to actually have said that the CPUC has been doing a better job over the last few years since the San Bruno explosion in regulating PG&E. However, I think there's also a lot of questions about whether they're looking at the books hard enough, whether they're doing things like that, or do they have enough staff to perform necessary audits, those kinds of questions. And this one of the things that this bankruptcy is really teasing out, actually, are some very complicated jurisdictional questions. So the bankruptcy judge can direct how PG&E is going to spend money, reorganize things like that. But at the end of the day, the CPUC is the one who's in charge of safety of Californians. That's part of their charter. Mm-hmm. They're in charge of our rates. They have to approve any kind of rate hikes. We've already heard some tussling as well with federal energy regulators, with FERC. That came up in the hearing today as well. They have concerns and jurisdiction over reliability. And so we're going to see how that plays out in the months and years to come.
Yeah, that really speaks to the kind of complication of being an investor-owned utility that provides a public service and essentially has a monopoly. There's not just one oversight commission here. There are multiple, and that can make things very complicated. And as you say, to your point, jurisdictionally, it's kind of hard to know sometimes where the lines are.
And not just a monopoly, but they have a guaranteed rate of a return, right? They get 10.5% for shareholders regardless under their rate structure with the PUC. And I do think that that's one thing that we're going to be watching really carefully is not just how does the PUC react, but how does the new governor and this legislature react? They have the power, of course, through legislation to direct the PUC to act in any number of ways that they choose. And we just saw the governor appoint his first person to the CPUC. That's a woman who had served on the Sacramento Municipal Utilities District for 20 years, so mm-hmm. a public power agency. She will probably bring a different point of view and hopefully expertise to the commission. And I've also heard, you know, some rumors that there could be a change in the president of the commission. And if that happened, would Michael Picker stick around? We don't know.
And speaking of Sacramento, SMUD, it is often held up as a model. You know, we don't know how this story ends for PG&E, but we often hear SMUD brought up as, you know, maybe we should be doing it that way.
Yeah, there's a lot of different options for how we could structure utilities in California, and that's certainly something that the public has brought up. That was a big conversation at the commission meeting on Monday. There's going to be another public commission meeting on Thursday in Sacramento, and I think we're going to hear a lot of people calling for that.
And just quickly, I think it's important to note that, as you know, I think any sort of holding up SMUD is fair. It's also fair to say PG&E is a much different animal, right? This is a huge, the biggest utility in the state. It covers hundreds of miles, 16 million customers. It's a different undertaking than serving, you know, one county.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's bring in State Senator Bob Hertzberg now. He represents parts of the Los Angeles area. He was Assembly Speaker during the 2001 PG&E bankruptcy. Senator Hertzberg, great to have you here. Thank you for joining us.
No, thanks for including me.
Well, the legislature passed a bill last year, SB 901, which was aimed at preventing this exact scenario, a bankruptcy. That was before the campfire, the worst state, the worst in our history. What are you and your colleagues intending to do now?
Well, look, can I back up? I've been listening to the conversation, and we tend to get our nose too close to the glass with respect to PG&E. They're just not relevant to our larger question. The question is, how do we provide safe, reliable power, deal with the environmental issues, protect the public in this, as Jerry Brown says, the new abnormal? What you just heard from all the folks talking was this is not a bankruptcy. This is a climate change bankruptcy. There is no risk except a threatened risk. And the markets reacted in a way that caused all of the creditors to say, you got to pay me in cash. They had to give out all their cash. And their stock falling. We see hedge fund operators last year all around this thing, folks in the hedge fund world, and they own larger shares of this stuff. At the end of the day, the bankruptcy court has one interest, and that is to make sure all the creditors get paid. You get a creditors committee at some point, and they pay everybody. You could have all this taken care of, and a fire in 2022 and a fire in 2023. That fire could be in SMUD's district, or it could be in Los Angeles Municipal, in the Department of Water and Power's district. We had a fire last year, cost $100 million. Our insurance rates, I talked to the chief operating officer of the district in Los Angeles, and their insurance went up to $36 million a year and going up. So it's all about trying to deal with natural disasters to protect the public.
Right.
And until you figure that out, we can get through this in the near term, but we still are not facing the underlying core problem. And that's what we're trying to address in the California legislature.
Attorney Amanda Riddle.
I would agree that climate change needs to be addressed. I would agree that these fires are more disastrous because of climate change. But what we've seen over the last several years is that PG&E as a utility is far more irresponsible than any other utility we have in this state. They've been responsible for the deaths of over 130 people in the last 8 years. It's a corporate culture of profits over safety. And I think that does need to be addressed. I would agree that we can get all the way through this bankruptcy and still leave PG&E in the same format that it's in now, and there'll be a fire in 2020 and a 2022. So I do think reorganization of the company, looking at what role the CPUC plays, looking at what role the legislature plays is incredibly important in this reorganization.
Yeah, can I get your reaction to that, Senator Hertzberg? Because you have seen this corporate culture
I have
from
seen this
2001
culture.
To today.
And okay, then all these directors are going to be taken out. All the management's going to be taken out. There's clearly issues with respect to safety and the like. There's no question about that. But what I'm trying to deal with is the larger dynamic of how do we deliver in these new challenging times electricity. So it was mentioned earlier that these things are monopolies, just like municipal utilities are monopolies. And we have for the last 20 years been trying to integrate renewables and changing our standards and the like. And so this is a new challenge. We've seen it in Florida. We have a 20% surcharge. We've seen an earthquake. We created an earthquake authority after, in my neck of the woods, we had the Northridge earthquake, and to be able to come up with an alternative structure. We've seen it in medical malpractice where the cost of doctors' coverage was too great. It requires certainly this is critically important. I don't want to diminish the PG&E situation, but I also don't want to lose the larger framework of what our job is in the legislature, and that is to make sure that we deliver reliable power. There's no brownouts and blackouts like there was 20 years ago, that we protect the ratepayers. And somebody talked about earlier the $8 billion for ratepayers. Well, we were writing checks in this legislature for $500 million a week that isn't calculated into what the total costs were, that taxpayers were picking up the tab for these ratepayers, you know, during this time of the energy crisis. None of that we want to have happen. But we do need a rational approach to a natural disaster approach that we've seen in other parts of the country and in other areas of public policy. That will deal with the larger issue, and hopefully if we take care of that earlier, can move us and not be in a position where we have a three-year bankruptcy.
So, Marisa Lagos, I want to get your take, because you cover politics, state politics, closely. How would you say sentiment has changed among the politicians that you speak to towards this company? Because they don't oversee PG&E, but they do oversee the CPUC, which oversees the company.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that it's definitely not a friendly situation up there. We heard during those SB 901 hearings last year, really some anger from lawmakers about specifically PG&E. Ben Hueso, for example, who heads the Senate Utilities Committee, at one point said, I don't even want to talk about PG&E because I feel like they're such an outlier compared to the other utilities who have really, especially in San Diego, for example, been aggressive about putting cameras out and monitoring wind conditions so that they can proactively turn off power. I guess, you know, Senator, I'd be interested in your take on that, because I do think that there does seem to be a difference. And you know, I think that the CPUC itself is a big challenge. We may not have time to get more
just
from the Senator.
Just very quickly, Senator, if you can, in just 30 seconds.
Yeah, very quickly. Look, the bottom line is that all the other utilities are now getting downgraded. They're worried about the larger problem, and we're starting to see a much bigger, across the board, in all parts of the state, a greater interest, whether they're municipalities, whether the CCAs or whatever, in terms of taking a more holistic approach. And I'm starting to see that past. You know, we'll punish PG&E for all the things that were articulated and deal with safety issues, but we've got to deal with the larger issue in terms of delivery of electricity
all
to
right.
every corner of California.
State Senator Bob Hertzberg, we thank you for joining us.
I think Marisa brings up a great point when she compares PG&E to SDG&E. After the witch fires in 2007, SDG&E made a lot of changes, and they have been a leader in California when it comes to a utility who's preventing wildfires now. They have policies of having reclosers turned off during high wind events, de-energizing their lines during high wind events, and PG&E can learn from that.
Marisa Lagos, why don't you finish us off here? What comes next in this process?
Well, again, we'll be watching Sacramento. Do they direct the CPUC to do anything? But more short term, on Thursday, Judge Montali will hold the next hearing. He's going to rule on more than a dozen motions that are basically aimed at keeping the lights on, so to speak.
All right. KQED's Marisa Lagos, Lisa Pickoff-White, Amanda Riddle, who represents wildfire victims. Thanks to all three of you. And that is a wrap for this special edition of the California Report. We'll have more coverage of PG&E's bankruptcy tomorrow morning on the California Report and online at kqednews.org. Our engineer was Seal Muller. Our producer is Polly Stryker. And our director is Guy Marzorati. Vinnie Tong is our managing editor. Ethan Lindsay is our executive editor for news. And Holly Kernan is our chief content officer. I'm Lily Jamali. Thank you so much for listening.